translation. The proposals submitted by King Indra were immediately accepted by Bali Maharaj and his assistants, headed by Shambhara and Arishtanemi, and by all the other residents of Tripura. Purport. It appears from this verse that politics, diplomacy, the propensity to cheat, and everything we find in this world, in individual and social negotiations between two parties, are also present in the upper planetary systems. The demigods went to Bali Maharaj with the proposal to manufacture nectar, and the daityas, the demons, immediately accepted it, thinking that since the demigods were already weak, when the nectar was produced, the demons would take it from them and use it for their own purposes. The demigods, of course, had similar intentions. The only difference is that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu, was on the side of the demigods, because the demigods were his devotees, whereas the demons did not care about Lord Vishnu. All over the universe, there are two parties, the Vishnu party, or God-conscious party, and the godless party. The godless party is never happy or victorious, but the God-conscious party is always happy and victorious. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Well, Oma Gyana Timurandasya Gyananjana Shilakaya Chakshurum Militang Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. That's the conclusion, folks. Why does Kripamoya Das have to say anything more? Everything's already been spoken. We just run out the door and tell the world. Have breakfast a little earlier today. There was no need for Srimad Bhagavatam class, because in the purport, we got everything. We got it. Okay? So why do we have a Bhagavatam class if we have the purport? Why not just have a kirtan, read the purport, have breakfast, and hit the street, and tell the world? Good question. What do you think? Good question. Good question is, the question is that we don't get it, unfortunately. We really don't. And that's why you can have a Bhagavatam class every single day of your life, and you may still not get it. Because that part of you which is demonic really doesn't get it. Because the demons don't get Vishnu, the prophet says here. They don't care for him. They don't understand him. Even he's right in front of them, they don't understand. They will always adjust their position to rule out Vishnu. Hiranyakashipu, classic example. He just didn't get Vishnu. He thought, I will kill Vishnu, I will cut off his head, and drink his blood. Okay, so already he is describing Lord Vishnu as someone ordinary who has a material body, who can be killed by someone who is materially strong. You see? And then when the pillar burst open and Vishnu was standing right in front of him, Hiranyakashipu, he saw him, but he really didn't see him. Couldn't see him. He saw a strange animal, half man, half animal, very strange. And in this, he was just like his brother. They had the same genetic code, Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu, same DNA. So when Hiranyaksha saw Lord Varaha, he said, oh, an amphibious beast, a pig who can swim, so what? I'll finish him off very quickly. So when Hiranyakashipu saw Lord Narasimhadev, he saw, oh, half man, half lion. Well, I've never seen him before, but come and have a go if you think you're hard enough. Come and have a go at me. I've vanquished everybody else. And the pillar that he came out of was the pillar upon which had been carved all the heads of everyone that Hiranyakashipu had ever killed or conquered. It was the Vijay Stambha. It wasn't just a pillar holding, it wasn't just any pillar. It was the pillar. The pillar that had, you can see this in Roma. There's a place in Roma near Piazza del Piano. And it's a big pillar. And the Romans put up a big pillar. It's, you know, twice as wide as this. If you go there, it's got all the story of how, you know, the whole story, who was conquered, who won, who lost. You know, it's like, you know, a permanent reminder of our triumph. People like to do that. You know, a triumphal arch you know, in the middle of Paris, the Arc de Triomphe, okay? Or Trafalgar Square, you know, commemorate a big column with Nelson at the top, commemorating a famous battle where he won and everybody lost. So every conqueror, every conqueror likes to have an arch of triumph, a pillar of triumph. So here's Hiranyakashipu's. It was in stone, carved into stone, all the heads of the men that he'd conquered. And out of this very pillar, which he didn't expect anybody to come, he said, well, is God in this pillar? In this pillar? My favorite pillar? Is he here? Because if he's here, I'll show him. He says, yes, he's there. Then I will kill him. I'll kill him too. See all these people? I've killed them and I'll kill him too. So he was confronted with Vishnu, but he couldn't see because he didn't care for him. Because he didn't imagine that he had a relationship with Vishnu. And if you don't imagine that you have a relationship with Vishnu, then you don't have one. Or you don't have a living one. You have a relationship because that's something that can never be taken away from you. But you don't have a relationship as in a relationship that you're working on. Like I have a relationship with every single person in the Watford phone book. An intrinsic existential relationship with every single person in Watford. But it's inactive. It's dormant. What is my relationship with that person? I live within a 20-mile radius of that person. So I have a relationship with them. But the relationship is dormant. It's not activated. If I go into Watford, I go into the Harlequin Center, which I don't actually, the Temple of Doom. I hate shopping. I really hate shopping. The only time I get near shopping centers when we go on Harinam or we walk through, but I really don't like shopping. So anyway, if on some very strange occasion I should go through the shopping center in Watford, and that person in the telephone book is walking past me, then the relationship develops. The relationship increases, but it's still dormant. So Vishnu can be right in front of you, but the relationship is dormant because you don't wish for it to become active. So the whole point of bhakti is, first of all, convincing you that the relationship not only exists, because you're there, you know that, you're convinced of that. Vishnu is there. That's the first step in convincing you that God is there. Second, that the relationship is intrinsic to you and to him. That the relationship between you and God is something that is that you cannot be separated from, that it's eternal. That it's something that's meant to be restored. And then the third aspect is how to develop that relationship. What is the mantra that you need in order to develop that relationship? What is the tantra? What is the activities that you need to do in order to develop that relationship? So in different ways you begin, and that's the path of bhakti. But it's all about what the relationship is. It is a conscious relationship, and therefore our movement is known as the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. That's all we're trying to do, develop consciousness. Yes, we build temples, we sell books, we cook food and offer it to the Lord and we distribute it and we jump up and down and we do everything. But the whole point is, what are you conscious of? Who are you conscious of? How is your consciousness developing? You see? And that's the difference between ritualism, religious ritualism, and a path of spirituality. Religious ritualism means everybody comes to the temple, we sing, we go home. There are some people who come to this temple, and we know who they are. We have spied them. They come to the temple, do their pranams in front of Krishna, and then they go to McDonald's on the corner on their way home. We know they do. Their consciousness of Krishna is something that they want. That's why they come. But not enough to develop it after the moment of religious ritualism has finished. A devotee of Krishna does the rituals, but keeps the consciousness going during the day by always trying to think of Krishna and trying never to forget Krishna. So the effort that you make to become Krishna conscious, even when externally there's no stimuli for that, it's quite easy to be Krishna conscious in a temple. And therefore, one of the biggest challenges to our devotees is that we train them how to be Krishna conscious in a Krishna conscious temple. But when they leave the ashram, can they be Krishna conscious in another setting? On a wet Tuesday morning, when the bills come through the door, and you've hardly got any furniture, and your memories of the ashram are dwindling, and you're in a new situation, can you then be Krishna conscious? That's the test. So I say, really, we should be training our devotees here in the ashram for life beyond the ashram. Otherwise, what we shall have is very Krishna conscious devotees in the ashram and not very Krishna conscious people outside the ashram. Because believe me, young men, young ladies, life outside the ashram is tough. Did you know, for instance, that life outside the ashram, no one comes and wakes you up? How inconsiderate. People do not come and wake you up at the right time in the morning. Isn't it? And no one cooks breakfast for you. I mean, how outrageous. Isn't that? And no one gives, no entertaining and informative speaker will give a Bhagavatam class over a microphone to keep you awake and stimulated so that you can head out on the day. It's all up to you. So in the ashram, we learn the techniques of self-responsibility, being responsible to become Krishna conscious. Even you get initiated, the guru doesn't make you Krishna conscious. Some of you who are initiated may have noticed that. That no matter, you may be initiated by this Mahatma or this great Swami or this one or this one. It doesn't matter who you've got initiated by. The imperative to become Krishna conscious is still yours. The guru cannot make you Krishna conscious, especially by remote control. And even you come into the guru's presence, if you're not cultivating Krishna consciousness, if you allowed some part of your heart, some part of your mind to be dominated by the anti-party, the non-Vishnu party, then to that extent you'll be non-Vishnu conscious, non-Krishna conscious. So we have a problem. And we have a problem in that doubts come to us. Doubts come to us. And these doubts take us down the garden path of mental speculation. Have you ever had one of those japa periods? I usually find on a Tuesday morning. If you've overindulged, of course, this is in the old days when you could actually overindulge in a Sunday feast. Here at Bhaktivedanta Manor, you can't actually overindulge in a Sunday feast. It's not a traditional Sunday feast. So, but in the old days, there was something called sweets. And you would overindulge on a Sunday. Monday would be a bit sleepy. And wham, on Tuesday morning, the japa period, we would be in technicolor. Very difficult japa period. The mind would be replaying the movie. You know, instead of Tom Cruise, it's you. Instead of the big hero, it's you. And in your mind, you're being led down a garden path. And then at the end of the japa period, just before 7 o'clock, somebody stands up and he says, Jaya Radha Gokula. And you think to yourself, what's he got to be cheerful about? Huh? Who does he think he is? But your japa period has been a complete walk through a jungle of old memories, new memories, projected thoughts into the future. You as the hero, you as the victim. That's another good one, isn't it? I would be Krishna conscious if only these people would get out of my way. If only the temple was organized the way I'd like to organize it, then I would be Krishna conscious. You see. So, doubts can be based on material desires. Doubts can be based on philosophical gaps in the jigsaw puzzle of the intellect. The intellect is like a big jigsaw puzzle. We're trying to put the different pieces together so that we can make logical connections, especially if you're a logical, Western, scientific brain. Okay? We want Krishna consciousness to be logical, systematic, and scientific. No gaps. So we try to fill in those gaps. If you filled in those gaps, then that's good. At least you're logically convinced, and you can go forward with practice. But if you're not logically convinced, the same doubt will keep coming over and over again. Well, before I got initiated, I was worried about this. Then I got initiated, and it was all right for a while. Now I've been initiated for 3 years. Watch out. After you've been initiated for 3 years, it becomes very dangerous. Why? Because you've been initiated for 3 years. You see? And you think you know everything. Before you're initiated, you think you know everything. Then you get initiated and you become a little bit humble. After initiation, 3 years later, you think you know everything. Then if you survive that, 10 years later, my God, then you really do know everything. And you look in the mirror and you think, Bhaktivedanta Man is so fortunate that I'm still involved. The day I came into the world was the day that Krishna consciousness had an extra boost. People should be very grateful that I'm still giving my presence to the Krishna consciousness movement. And today, if anyone's not grateful, if they don't respect me enough, then I shall conquer them. So how is it that you become proud? How is it that you become proud? Pride can enter in at any moment. Doubt can enter in at any moment. Desires can enter in at any moment. And that's, if anything, when we read the Bhagavatam, we should read that problems can come at any time. In the last chapter, we were reading about Gajendra. These two chapters, Gajendra Mokshana and Sagar Manthan, they tell us that a couple of things. One is that danger can come at every moment. You know, there I was with my wives, just enjoying the, you know, Trikuta Mountains. It was wonderful. There was lotuses. I just went for a swim, and all of a sudden this crocodile grabbed my leg. I didn't know what to do. Well, I prayed to Vishnu, and after some time he came. That's the story. But the story for us is that danger can come at every moment. So when one is enjoying, or when one is thinking, you know, I'm quite a devotee, you know, I got my service, now I got a department, you know, I got my guru, I got, you know, that's then the crocodile comes, not before. Then the crocodile comes. Or the demigods are thinking, actually, you know, we're okay. We know Vishnu, we appreciate who he is, we're Vaishnavas. And then they're smashed. They're completely smashed by the demons. And then in their smashiness, they have to call out to the Lord, Pahimam, Pahimam, for safety. So how can we avoid doubt, pride, lethargy, apathy, and all these things coming in? Well, someone asked me that question the other day, and I said, well, that's why as devotees, we do a lot of rituals that involve giving our power away to others. This for a nation trained on psychology and psychotherapy and transactional analysis is not a very good thing. Never give your power away to another person, especially a religious teacher, a rabbi, a priest, a guru. Don't give your power away. Be yourself. Always be yourself. Well, that's all well and good, but part of the process is taking the Vaishnava as emblematic or symbolic of Vishnu himself. That's the whole point. When Krishna says tad vidhi pranipatena, it's the pranipat that a lot of people have difficulty with. It's the surrender that people have difficulty with. Because that goes right to the heart of who we think we are. And the self-abasement that comes. For instance, what are we doing, actually? We're bowing down. We're bowing down to another human being. Do you know how dangerous that is? Do you know if you go to any psychologist, any psychotherapist, they will say, why have you done that? Why have you bowed down to another person? Why have you, for God's sake, why have you allowed another person to tell you what to do with your hair? Look at you. You've cut all your hair off. We were just hearing from Gaura Gopal Prabhu about Draupadi, and you know the whole thing with two occasions when two Kshatriyas were the hair was cut off, and that's a big deal. For someone to cut their hair off is a big deal. You know, now it's become quite fashionable. When I was a kid, to remove all your hair meant that you were a very violent criminal, or you had cancer. That's why the devotees in the 1970s, that's why we used to go out with wigs. We used to go out with wigs because the 1970s was the decade when everybody wore their hair long. So to have a shaved head and to try and sell books, it was just absolutely impossible. And you may think about that now and you can think, you just should have had the determination and the Krishna consciousness that we have in the 2000s. Then you would have been able to do it. No, it wasn't like that. Long hair was, you know, as everybody had long hair. I saw a photograph of myself in 1976, leading a kirtan, banging a drum. The only thing I do, banging a drum. I've been looking at photographs for, this 40th anniversary magazine. Going back since, you know, the time I joined, I have some photographs that we've... And it's all... It's just banging a drum. Banging a drum, as if that's going to make the world Krishna conscious. Banging a drum. Big cheesy grin. Banging a drum. But I looked at those pictures, and every single person around me had long hair and a Mexican mustache. Everybody. The women, the men, everybody. So to go out with no hair. So we wore wigs to cover it over. And sometimes the police would, you know, when you're in the Sankirtan van, it's not a very good situation for keeping your wig in the best, you know, best condition. So we would put these wigs on and sometimes holes would appear. But being brahmacharis, we didn't care. So we went out with wigs sometimes with holes on. And people would, we'd try to sell them a book and they'd look and there would be an eye flick. And they would try to be very respectful. Because if a man is wearing a wig, especially a woman should never notice. You should never notice. But sometimes they would, and their eyes would be going with it. And they'd look at the book and then they'd look up and they'd look at the book and they'd look up. And then they would go and tell the police. And then the police would come and they'd be all very nice. And they'd take us to the station. And then very gently they would say, "So is that a wig you're wearing?" And we'd say, "What?" And they'd say, "Is that a wig you're wearing?" Not, well. And of course, we would be the laugh of the police station. Why am I telling you this? Anyway, the point is, Prabhupada said in the seventh canto, he wrote a little bit of encouragement for us. He said, sometimes Vaishnavas come in disguise. He was talking about how the Vaishnavas had come to teach Prahlad Maharaj what he knew. He said, Sandana Marka, you must be very careful because sometimes the Vaishnavas come in disguise. So we disguise anyway. The point is here that we have to fill in the gaps. We have to fill in the gaps. And especially as you get older, one thing that has happened now is that religion has gaps. It was all right in the 1970s. We were exotic, Indian, Eastern. No one knew the hell what Hinduism was or what Eastern people believed. They would just ask us on the street, so what do you think the Bible says about what you're doing? And especially was when I was like, you know, 22 or something like that. They would say, sometimes the Christians would put their hand on my shoulder, "Are you all right, son? Are you all right, son? Do you know that Jesus loves you? Jesus loves you." Do you ever think that you've chosen the wrong path? And I would say, no. And one time we stayed in a monastery And both a priest and two nuns came to myself and another devotee. And we told them what our lifestyle was and what time we got up in the morning. And, you know, celibate monks, and we get up at 3 in the morning and we, you know, live a life of dedication. We eat once a day. And, you know, they were just shaking their heads. And they were saying, "Oh, why don't you join us? You're already, you're gems." That was the word that the priest, he said, he says, "You're gems." He said, "We really need people like you in the Catholic Church." He said, "Why don't you just join us?" So, the difficulty is, though, that as life goes by, religion itself has come under attack because religion has been misused. This is the point in these days now when we see there's 40 different wars going on, and most of them are in some way Islamic based. In other words, very passionate understanding of one particular text has led people to, in the name of one particular religion, has said that the world must be again reconquered and a caliphate reestablished. So what that has done to people is it's forced them to look at Krishna consciousness not just as it compares to Christianity, the religion that they know, but as it compares to the religion that they think they know now, the dangerous one, the cultic one, the sectarian one, the malevolent, violent one, the one whereby, I dress as a devotee when I go to London. And sometimes when I go on the tubes, I wear my rucksack. Well, there's nothing that clears a space on a tube than a man wearing a dhoti with a rucksack, especially a few years ago. You could see people just get up and walk away from you, especially after the, you know, after the bombings on the tube. And people avert their eyes, they check you out, and very, very, you know. So now we are not compared to biblical reality. We are compared to an Islamic reality. And people are comparing us and saying, just like when there was this big mass suicide in Jonestown in Guyana. 900 people died. 900, the teacher told everybody to commit suicide. 900 people died. That was in 1977, 76, 75. And the newspapers in this country were coming to us and they say, "Would Hare Krishna ever commit mass suicide, you know, here at the manor?" And we said, "Well, surprisingly, no, we wouldn't. It's against our religion." And they said, "Yes, but if you all did commit mass suicide, how would you do it?" And that's the bit they want to print, where the devotee says, "Well, if we did all commit mass suicide, what we would do is," you know, and the headline in the newspaper the next day would have been, if I had answered that question, the headline would have been, "Hare Krishna say they will commit mass suicide through poisoning the Maha," or something like that. So you've got to be very, very careful. Because what's happening now is people have a concept of what religion is and the danger it can be. And then they look at you, especially if you go out in robes, and they say, "Yes, they're happy people, but this can also happen to them because they are serving a god of their own imagination." So what we have to do is we have to, first of all, defeat the neo-atheists, the neo-atheists, the Hitchens, the Harris, the Dawkins, the people who are beginning from 5 years ago, and you know, after people are really intellectually screwing themselves around in the head to try and figure out how to defeat the dangers that religion poses to the world. So we have to be able to say that yes, this has religious principles, but actually it's based on logic and it's based on philosophy. And your logic has to be systematic. You cannot just go out into the world and say, you're not your body, therefore Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There's huge gaps in between. And people may not jump to Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead very quickly. You have to go quite slowly. And what's happening now is, of course, that people are forming a circuitous route to Krishna consciousness. They're doing yoga, and from yoga they're learning a little bit about Patanjali. From Patanjali they're learning a little bit about, you know, Vedanta. From Vedanta they understand the Upanishads are very important. And they're trying to understand the Upanishads. So we have to understand the Upanishads, and we have to be able to replicate the arguments that the Acharyas have given within the Upanishads in order to establish ourselves. It's just not good enough. Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is too much of a logical jump. It's too inconsistent for most people who are already primed that a god of any kind, you know, the anti-Vishnu party has dominated everything now. At the dinner parties in this country and in many parts of the world, people now think that it's more intellectual to be an atheist and even to profess atheism than they do to believe in God. The new religion, so to speak, is to believe that you can be a good person without God. That you don't need the concept of God in order to be kind, compassionate, just, loving, peaceful. You don't even need a concept of God in order to have a transcendent experience. And people feel comfortable with that. Our business is to get them past that point. And this is what Madhvacharya does. This is what Ramanujacharya does. This is what Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu does. This is what Srila Prabhupada does. He uses the Upanishads to get people above that. Because within the Upanishads there's a consistent logical progression of understanding. Now we only have 5 minutes, and let's see if I can share something with you whereby... Just see. Let's see. As I was saying. Huh? You've seen something? It's behind you? Where? Under the... Well, look at that, see? We have to look a little harder. So, that's why okay, here's the logical progression in shall I do it? Do we have time? Or just okay. The Taittiriya Upanishad says the nature of Brahman is satyam. It is real, or rather, let me begin. So the question is, what is ultimate reality? You're at a dinner party. What is ultimate reality? Now, you have to, you kind of have, through argumentation, you have to bring people to the point that the senses are insufficient in themselves to be adequate pramanam to be articulators of the ultimate reality. You can't depend on argument. You can't depend on the senses. It's the beginning of the Vedanta Sutra. Beginning of the Vedanta Sutra is all about you cannot use the senses. You cannot use argument. So having got your dinner party guests there, which is the entire dinner party, what is the ultimate reality? Well, within the philosophical portion of the Vedas, we find that the Upanishads say that the ultimate reality is described by different words. And here's where it gets to, you have to be careful, because these different words are Sat, Atman, Brahman, Paratattva, and Paramjyotish. These are all different words used in the Upanishads for the supreme reality or the supreme truth. In the Taittiriya Upanishad, there's a very famous dialogue between Varuna, the one Devata, and Bhrigu, one great sage, son of Brahma. And he says that the ultimate reality can be defined as that from which everything is born, by which everything is sustained, and to which everything enters into at the end. And we have just had that definition given by Lord Brahma when he praises Lord Narayan as he appears. Just before Lord Narayan says, well, what you should do is churn the ocean, Lord Brahma is glorifying him and says these things. He says, it's just like a clay pot. The clay comes out of the earth, it forms a pot, and at the end goes back to the earth. Okay. So then Srila Vyasadeva in the Vedanta Sutra says, Janmadi Asya Yataha. The supreme truth is that from which everything comes. So this one quality, Jagat Karanatva means he's the source of the universe. So we also hear these expressions that he is Chaitana Vastu. Chaitana Vastu. See, the Upanishads, really, you have to cherry pick. You have to go through them and you have to pick the gems. So we see Chaitana Vastu, which means sentient being. Chaitan. The logical conclusion here is that only a conscious being can create a conscious universe. That there must be within that supreme being sankalpa, or volition, or the will to create the universe. I'm losing people in droves now. I gotta go. I gotta feed my puppy. I have to do an offering. So shall I tell another story? And then, so then there must be ikshana. Ikshana means will. If you say that there is a time of creation and that there is a determination, that there's a point in eternity before which there was no creation, then there's a creation, you have to say that there's sankalpa, let there be creation, and ikshana, I shall create. So then you take this and you say, well, but hang on a minute, how is Brahman synonymous with Lord Vishnu? This is what we're trying to prove as Vaishnavas, you see. So then you turn to the Mimamsakas. The Mimamsakas are a school of philosophers who also taught logic, how to get logic from the Vedas. And they say that the Upanishads have to be interpreted by the principles laid down by this particular school. So, for instance, they say that in the Vedas, when it says that you sacrifice, some sentences you will have, you sacrifice an animal or pashu, and then another another sentence is the recommendation is sacrifice a chaga or goat. Therefore, when it says pashu, you should understand that it also means chaga. Okay, that when one thing is a little disclosed, when there's something that is more specific, you know, I saw the boy with a jumper. I did see the boy with the jumper. What did you see? I saw a boy with a green jumper. Well, then you refer back to the first two sentences, and the boy was always wearing a green jumper. It just wasn't disclosed in the first. You see? That's a logical connection. So in the Chandogya Upanishad, we find the word to describe the Lord is Sat. In Aitareya Upanishad, it's Atman. Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad is Brahman. The Maha Upanishad is Narayana. And Panini, who is in charge of the grammar, you can't just take the Vedas and make up your own meaning. You have to go according to grammar. Now, I've met the Shankaracharya, and it's interesting. We think that the Shankaracharyas, because they're impersonalists, they're also atheists. They're not. They actually believe in God, but they believe in God as, you know, devoid of personal attributes. But they say, actually, that the Vedas are the only way that you can know this God, whoever he is. You know, we may disagree, but the Vedas are the only way that you can know this God. And then you have to follow the rules according to Panini. There's got to be rules. It sounds Italian, doesn't it? Panini. But you have to follow the rules according to Panini. And is Vyakaran. So if you follow those rules, you understand that Narayan, the way the word is constructed, is a personal name. It's a noun which describes Brahman, Atman, and all these others. Well, there's lots more I could say. But it comes to a wonderful discussion. From the Upanishads, we go to something else that was consistent. It was running at the same time. Contiguous? Contemporaneous with the Upanishads, and that is the Agamas, or the Pancharatra. When we look in the Mahabharata, we find Bhishmadev mentioning the Pancharatra. Pancharatra, the Vedas, is mantra, and also tantra, but the Agamas is specifically for worship. So Pancharatra, when you put flowers on Prabhupada's feet in the morning, you're following an ancient tradition. Why don't you put flowers on Prabhupada's head? Why do you bow down with the left side towards Prabhupada? Why are the deities just on a particular level? Why are there 16 upacharas offered to the deities every day? Why are there 6 services? Because it says so in the Pancharatra Agama. This is what we follow. And extracts from the Pancharatra Agama find their way into the Hari Bhakti Vilas. So one lady, Professor Anna Knight, she came here and she wanted to talk about ritual. And she came to me quite perplexed. She says, Kripa Moya, I've tried to talk to the devotees about ritual, and they say they don't do any rituals. They just do bhakti. And I said, really? They said, yes, I was asking about the rituals, you know, ringing the bell when you come in and bowing down and then moving over to the curtain, Govindam prayers and moving back, Prabhupada, Kijai, and the Prema Dwani and everything like that. And they say, that's not a ritual. I said, well, because they define, sometimes when you say ritual to a devotee, they think you're meaning empty ritual, you see, as in something done that's a meaningless gesture whose purpose has been forgotten. I said, you have to clarify it to them. But I said, it's a little bit like a goldfish in a bowl. I said, if you ask a goldfish, how's the water? The goldfish will say to you, what water? I can't see any water. Because ritual is all around us. You know, the fact that I'm sitting on a seat that's higher than the seat that you're sitting on, right? The fact that we do Om Namo Bhagavate, the fact that it's the Bhagavatam and not naughty stories, the fact that it's, you know, everything that we do, that I've got tilak, that you're sitting there with tulsi beads, everything, we're surrounded, completely permeated by ritual. And it goes back many, many thousands of years. But the ritualistic content of how to practice what's in the Vedas, that is known as tantra. So tantra doesn't mean anything bad. It simply means something that goes along with mantra. You have mantra and you have tantra. When people say tantra yoga, they're actually meaning the Vama Marga. Vama Marga means the left-handed tantra, the left-handed path, which is all about doing things to control things in this material world. We're also involved in controlling things in this material world. We're also involved. We're controlling the mind. We're controlling the senses. We're controlling our intellect. You see? We're controlling our hair style. We're controlling our time. We're controlling a lot. But Vama Marga says, hey, if you control those things, you can actually control different features of the world. Like in Rishikesh, there's a lady who's the wife of the postmaster, and she's been worshipping Lord Shiva for 30 lifetimes. And she can see things that are invisible. And sometimes ISKCON devotees go to her if they've lost their passport or they've lost something, or someone, you know, really doesn't like them, or they love someone and they want to influence them. So sometimes ISKCON devotees go to Rishikesh. And if they go to Rishikesh, you should ask them, what did you do there, Prabhuji? So she's called the Rice Lady. And you go in. Of course, I haven't been there. You go in. And you hold on to some rice, and you think of what you would really like to achieve, or the person that you really want to be put in contact with, or the object that you've lost. And after doing that, you give her the rice. And she covers the rice with her other hand, and she chants different Shiva mantras. And then she starts talking. And she talks in a sort of semi-trance, but she describes accurately. One devotee had lost his passport. He'd lost his entire briefcase. It was stolen. You know, it happens in India sometimes. So she said, oh, no, it's very easy. It's still in Rishikesh. And then she did, you go down the road, take the second on the left, walk up the stairs. It's the fourth door. It's painted green. You bang on the door very loudly, and he will give you back the briefcase. And it was a sannyasi, actually, ISKCON sannyasi. I'm not going to tell you the names. But he went, and he followed her directions. He banged on the door very loudly. And a person came to the door, and he said, it wasn't me, it wasn't me, it wasn't me. And he took the briefcase and he threw it out the door, slammed the door in the devotee's face. And the devotee thought, wow, well, that was pretty good for a few rupees. But her power, this is called Vama Marga, her power comes from Lord Shiva. If you want that, it's available. But it involves controlling your senses just as much as we are controlling our senses. It involves controlling your hair just as much as you're controlling your hair. Dressing as someone else tells you to dress. And putting something on your forehead as someone else tells you to do. But it will carry on for as long as you wish. And then you'll begin to lose your powers. So therefore, we don't do that. It's very interesting, but it's irrelevant to the path of the soul going. You have to be very, very developed to do, Tantra to become the humble, insignificant devotee of Vishnu. That's a very elevated state to be in. Very elevated state. I shouldn't even be here telling you this. You're so advanced. Really. Prabhupada said anyone who walks through the door and practices Krishna consciousness is a pure devotee of Krishna. Is there anyone who comes to Bhaktivedanta Mana and gathers and does the kirtan? He says he was a devotee in a previous life. So really, you're just catching up. But when you catch up to where you were in your last life, then you have to start moving forward, and then it gets tough. So then all the bits have to fit together. So we find in this conversation, I'm going to finish right now, there's a very famous conversation in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, very nice, between Udalaka and Yajnavalkya. And they're talking about this one very important word, antaryami. Antaryami. What is this aspect of Brahman that is not only remote so far, because we say tadure tadvantike, but tad antarasya sarvasya. He's so far away you cannot get to him ever, but he's so near that he's within you. So how is that possible? How is it possible that this Brahman is so far away and yet so in me? That's Isha Upanishad. It's so close. Still I can't see. So he says, what is this antaryami? And he says it's a little bit like, he gives him two nice examples. He says it's like, and you've heard this one, it's like the sun reflected in the waves of a body of water. You see the sunshine reflected, and you see the waves are making the sun ripple like this. So the sun has entered into the body of water, but the sun isn't rippling. The sun is unchanged. And then he says, it is also like the sun, the space, Akash, coming into, you know, when you go to Radharaman temple, you get a very small pot like that, filled with nice things. And then when you go to the king of Jayapur's palace, you see the huge pot that he brought to England with him. It is like this, like that, filled with Ganga Jal. He brought many of these. It's the biggest pot in India. Huge, great thing like that. I can't even make it. So, but the space inside the small Radharaman pot and the space in beside the king of Jayapur's pot, the pots are different shape. But the space is not a different shape. The space does not become conditioned upon being put in the pot. You see, it is the pot has the condition, the pot has the attribute of small or big, but not the space within it. So he says it is like that. He says that this antaryami, this Brahman, this paratattva who is within, is not conditioned by being within. Always remains aloof. So he's describing these things. And then we come to another very famous word, which is shariri. Shariri. That the universe itself is the body of God, who is the soul of the universe. Just like your body is your body and you're in control of that. So you think, look, I can move my hand, I can move my hand down, I'm in control. However, the Vedas say, this is just like two examples. This is like a dog is underneath a bullock cart. Did you come see the bulls yesterday? He said, just like the dog is underneath the bullock cart. And sometimes, I don't know if you've noticed this, but the dog is underneath the cart that is being pulled by the bullocks. And he looks sideways at people who are looking at him underneath the cart. And he's trotting underneath the cart. And it says, at that moment, he thinks, I'm pushing this cart. Just see, trot, trot, trot. He's a dog. He's underneath the cart. I'm pushing it forward. The positioning with respect to another moving body causes him to think that I am doing this. I am the doer. You see? And the other one, said he goes a little bit further under the cart and he sees the testicles of the bull. And he thinks, and now I will have a feast, because surely they will drop off very soon. And I will enjoy. So the Vedas are very earthy, you see. But no, this never happens. So you're not controlling, and you will never enjoy. It only seems that way. And that's the position of the soul within the small sharira, the body, and the big sharira, the universe, the jagat. Because the owner and controller of the big universe, the big body, and everything within it, you see, is Isha. And then we go to the Isha Upanishad and we find Isha Avasya. Isha Avasya. It's controlled by him. Isha Avasya. He's the controller. See? Isha Avasyam Idam Sarvam Jagat. The word is Jagat. Everything. Jagat Cham Jagat. Everything within the universe is controlled by him. So understanding this, and understanding that he's also Matarishvada Dati. Matarishvada Dati means he controls all the other controllers. So understanding this, you have to understand that he's the soul, he's the antaryami who has entered into the universe. So everything within the universe also includes your body. So he's also the controller of your body also. That means he's the controller of all. And that means because that is the ultimate reality, the process that we must engage in is the process by which we actually never, ever forget that reality. If we never forget that reality, we will always be conscious of the Supreme, and that is Krishna consciousness. Hare Krishna.